Welcome to Insight for Living. This weekend, Christians around the world will gather to celebrate the most significant event in history, when Jesus defied death and broke the chains of sin forever. And so it's appropriate to place our series on biblical parenting on hold for just a few days in order to focus entirely on the Easter story. Imagine what it was like to experience the resurrection of Jesus in real time. Today, Chuck has chosen to tell the story through the eyes of one of the disciples. But first, this celebration and song, Christ is Risen.
If you have your Bible with you, please open it to the middle of a sermon. Acts chapter 2 contains the words of Peter as he's delivering his very first sermon in all his life. And we pick up the declaration at verse 22 of Acts chapter 2. Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God, say those two words with me, but God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power.
Listening to Insight for Living. To search the Scriptures with Chuck Swindoll, be sure to download his newly formatted Searching the Scriptures studies by going to insightworld.org/studies. And now the message titled, When God Untied the Death Ropes.
There were so many things that Simon did not like about himself. Like all of us, they were there and they dogged his steps. It seemed as though it would take a miracle for them to change, and that miracle seemed never to happen. You could trace it all the way back to his childhood, when he was raised at his mother's knee, and she reserved some of those lectures for him, when his mouth would run ahead, and he would say those things he had no business saying, and she would sit him down on that bench, and she would say to him, Simon Barjona, when will you ever learn that your mouth is your major problem? It's going to get you into trouble as you get older. In fact, it already does. See that motto hanging on the wall? I got it from our very wise ancestor Solomon. He wrote it in his book, and to this day it has a message for you. In fact, for all of us. A man is held captive by his sins. They are ropes that catch and hold him. That's you, Simon. When will you ever learn? When will you get control of your anger? When will you stop saying things that are so inappropriate? When will you pause and realize that you're not the only kid in the block? Simon must have heard that lecture dozens of times growing up. He knew they were true. He knew each one, each word, each rebuke was deserved, but he just couldn't change. Part of the reason, he would tell himself, is that he picked it up from his father. After all, his name, Simon bar Jonah, Simon, son of John, tied him to him. I guess if he were Scandinavian, he would be Simon Johnson. But he's Galilean, and he was proud of it. Galileans are known for short fuses. And when they talk, it often looks like arguments. I've led enough tours of Israel to remember how often I've seen out in front of the bus what looked like almost a fist fight beginning to start. And I remember the time I said to our guide, look at those men, they're about to come to blows. He said, they're not coming to blows, they're Galileans talking to each other. That's how it works when you're Galilean. That's how it was with Simon. And that's how we got around it. Even though he was addicted to anger, saying more than he should have said, and when he said it, often it was out of place, inappropriate, and frequently absolutely wrong. He had heard the lecture from his rabbi down at the synagogue school, and I cannot imagine how many times he must have been sat down late after school, kept after school because he had misbehaved, and the rabbi told him, here we go again, same message. By the way, I understand the problem. I had my own seat in the principal's office as I was growing up in my high school. So my principal would say, go to your seat. And I thought that was sort of a badge of honor till my mother found out about it. That's another story. Simon had his own bench. And the rabbi would rebuke him because again and again there would be fistfights in the playground. There would be arguments that he would start because he was determined that he was right. On top of the anger was a stubborn pride. And he couldn't stop that either. It kept emerging, He was opinionated. He was self-centered. He was impulsive. He was Galilean. He loved the sea, perhaps because his father loved the sea. In those days, boys did what their dads did. If dad was a carpenter, the son became carpenter. If the dad was a farmer, son was a farmer. No doubt John was a fisherman. And maybe from John, the business of fishing fell into Simon's hands. And he loved the sea. He loved the feel of the nets and the catch when they would be full of fish, except when the net broke and out would come the oaths. And once again, the old Simon would appear again, but there was no one to hear. That's part of the reason he liked the sea. The fish never spoke, never told anybody. And there he was, all alone, often in the sea, doing what he loved to do. Little did he know what God had in mind for him, just as little do you know what God has in mind for you as you find yourself riveted to your own set of addictions and habits and things you can't seem to conquer even by growing older. That's why Simon's life speaks such volumes. His mother used to say, even the rabbi used to say, it's going to take a miracle for you to change. Simon had an older brother. We'll call him Andy. Andy was not a fisherman. Maybe he didn't like the sea. Perhaps he was one of those that was a little more like a dreamer. He liked to follow those other people like to follow, which drew him into the wilderness. And he listened from a distance to the baptizer as he spoke of the Lamb of God who would take away the sin of the world and ultimately pointed him out saying, that's him. That's him. I am not him. Follow him. Andrew heard that and his heart skipped a beat. The first thing he thought of was Simon. Simon needs to meet this one. And so he comes to Simon as he's late one afternoon mending his nets in the boat, and he says, Simon, I found him. Simon has heard words like this for a long time. He looks at his brother and he says, Andy, please, you've been following that wilderness weirdo so long. You believe everything he says. No, it's not him. It's Messiah. Come, find out for yourself. Well, this began a change in Simon's life he never would have dreamed. But this day was different. Because Andrew didn't mess around. He walked up to his brother, mending nets there in the boat, and he said to Simon, come. You've got to meet him. You've got to meet the Messiah. Well, Simon shrugged and said, how many messiahs are you going to find in your lifetime? You were here with two others 2 years ago, and here you are again with another messiah. No. Andrew says, this one is the real one. He wants to meet you. And if you look at John chapter 1, you will see exactly what happened when they met. Toward the end of the chapter, John records the event. Look for yourself. John 1, 41. Andrew found his brother Simon and said to him, we found the Messiah, which translated means Christ, the Anointed One. And he brought him to Jesus. Now watch closely. Here is a man who all of his life has longed for some way to conquer himself, some restraint on his tongue, some ability to get beyond his old nature, which he could never pull off like some of you. Truth be told, it may have become even an addiction, and you want so much to defeat it, to get rid of it, but it keeps emerging. Keeps coming back. But look at this encounter. Jesus looked at him and said, you are Simon Bar-Jonah. There's that name again. Like his mother used to call him. You know, mothers use middle names when they're angry. Simon Bar-Jonah. And they always emphasize the consonants. They spit those out. So he remembered that. He remembered, and Jesus called him that, sort of put him under the shadow of his father. But Jesus didn't finish the sentence until he said, that's not all there is to the story. You shall be called Rocky. The word really means rock. Petros, we get our word petrified from it, a hard rock. But I think I think his buddies, who may have been standing nearby, snickered when they heard Slippery Simon called Old Gibraltar. Just didn't seem to fit. Sort of like naming your hamster Goliath. Or that 6'8" kid that plays basketball in middle school and you call him Tiny. You know how we are. Or the bald-headed guy you call Curly. It never stops. We just have those names. And it sounded like one of those. Everybody else may call you Simon, but I'm telling you something. You are Petros. The others may have laughed. Simon didn't. For the first time in his life, he met someone who knew his own heart, knew what he wanted most. I would love to be that solid and sure. I would love to live to see the day when I'm not held captive by my own sins and when the ropes of my own flesh do not catch and hold me like my mother used to lecture. I would love to be what he has described. What a great moment. We pass over it because it's in a list of events as Jesus is getting his band together, choosing 12. He could have chosen 200, but he limited it to 12. And of all things, he chose Simon to be one of them. No, he didn't suddenly change. I mean, when you're that embedded in your own self, it doesn't just quickly go away, even if you walk in the shadow or eat alongside and spend time with Jesus of Nazareth. Still Simon. However, there were glimpses of greatness that emerged. I'm very impressed with him in Matthew chapter 16. Turn to that record, if you will, Matthew 16. The band of 12 is together. They're moving and ministering among the people in Galilee, sometime down into Judea, but most often in Galilee. And so they've gone up to the northern part of Galilee, Caesarea Philippi, and they're sort of hanging out together. They're weary. And Jesus is musing over who people say he is. And since these men have been in touch with many of the people, Jesus, in verse 13, asks the disciples, who do people say I am? What's the word on the street? Well, they don't hesitate. Some say you're the baptizer. Others have called you Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. But who do you say that I am? Now he's limited it to the 12. In fact, you can't see it in our English rendering. Who do you say that I am? You is plural. So allow me. Who do y'all say that I am? That's it. That fits. All y'all. Not surprisingly, Peter speaks for everybody. Before they can get a word out of their mouth, here's Peter. But for once, he is right. Is he ever? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Oh, what a moment for old Simon to come across as Petros. Look at Jesus' response. He even utters a beatitude. Blessed are you, Simon Barjona. Look, it's a beatitude. Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. You got that from heaven. That came from God. And Peter spoke outside himself when he said, you are Messiah. That's who we say you are. That's who I say you are. And Jesus' response is, it came from heaven. I also say that on this rock, but this is a different kind of rock. And this is a rock like a statement, not like the man, Peter, but like the statement you've made. On this rock, like declaration, I will build my church. This is a heaven-sent revelation. And I commend you, Simon, for listening and responding as you have. That is the exact truth. And it's upon that declaration, that rock-like statement, I will build my church. See the next verse? I say to you that you are, here it is, you are emerging as Petros. In this case, it represents not the man, Peter, but the statement, this declaration of truth, this creed. that you are Messiah, the Son of the living God. That's it. And on that basis, look at the prediction. Five words: I will build my church. Look at what follows. The old Simon emerges. Verse 21, from that time, don't miss that. From here on, the story changes. At least in the minds of the followers, these men who have left their nets, left their practices, left their careers to follow Jesus, they've thrown it all in. They're now hearing. Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up the third day. I'm not sure they even heard the last part. All they heard was killed, killed. The one you've been following, the one you believe in, the one you declare to be the Son of God, killed. You and I have had centuries to look back over history and to settle on the reality that Christ came to die. They are living it out right now. They've never read Matthew 16. They don't know what this is all about. All they hear is killed. So Simon, here we go again, 22, took him aside. A chill goes down my back when I read the next verb. He rebuked him. Whoa. It took a lot of audacity to do that, but of course, he's riding in the heels of his great statement that he made earlier, and maybe it's time for Jesus to listen to him. And he says to Jesus, God forbid, Lord, this shall never happen to you. I think it may have been said with that kind of passion. Please observe, the Lord does not mince words. In case you've had the opinion of Jesus that he was sort of meek and mild and milquetoast, look at his response. He turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan! I was reading that this week and finished the sentence, you are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest but man's. And I thought, oh. The embarrassment that must have brought, with the other 11 listening in, Jesus says to him, you speak like Satan. I can't imagine a more stinging reproof than that one. Can you imagine the embarrassment? Well, at least he pulled him aside. I don't know how many heard it, but I have a feeling it wasn't whispered, because old Gibraltar begins to crack. And the truth shows up where Simon lets it out that he's not ready to accept a dead Messiah. That doesn't fit logic. That can't be true. Maybe you struggle with some of these things about Jesus. If he's so powerful, how could he die? And if his plan is so great, why would sinful men take charge? And if he dies for the sins of the world, how could it be that godless men nail him to a cross? It's all a part of that predetermined plan, which has within it mystery and intrigue and some truths that cannot be easily explained. Certainly not to someone who has his mind made up. This will never happen to you. But as time passed, the tide of popular opinion turned against Jesus. And the disciples could feel it in the air. You could hear it from the words of Jesus' critics. And by, they get very, very close to the place of the arrest.
Listening to Insight for Living. Today, Chuck Swindoll brings a unique perspective on the Easter story through the eyes of one of the disciples, Peter. And there's much more teaching ahead on tomorrow's program. Chuck titled this message, When God Untied the Death Ropes. You can access the complete sermon by going online to insightworld.org. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. Or again, go online to insightworld.org. I'm Dave Spiker, inviting you to listen again tomorrow when we celebrate Easter through sacred music and a message from Chuck Swindoll here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, When God Untied the Death Ropes, was copyrighted in 2016, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2017 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.